Welcome back to the second portion of today's seminar regarding turning anxious anticipation into possibility thinking. We're going to continue talking more about other types of disorders and ways that anxiety tends to manifest in our clients, as well as some different treatment options for helping people move beyond anxiety. So we can talk about generalized anxiety versus obsessive compulsive types of anxiety. In general, as we talked about in the first section of today's seminar, there is, with anxiety disorders, this intolerance of uncertainty. There's this sense amongst people with anxiety disorders that it's so difficult for them to deal with any ambiguity. When things feel open-ended, it's extremely stressful. They feel like they can't control it. They can't predict it. Remember, for them, worry seems to be an advantage in their mindset. So with generalized anxiety, we see more of that worry. But it manifests a bit different with people with obsessive compulsive disorder. With them, we see more compulsions. So it's not necessarily more of the mental worrying about things. It's more, I've got to do something about it. Let me count enough times. Let me clean enough times. Let me do a certain action to undo the worry. So the way of coping with this intolerance of uncertainty tends to be a bit different for those with generalized anxiety versus obsessive compulsive disorder. We also see this quality of perfectionism, particularly strongly with those with OCD. With people with OCD, they tend to see perfectionism as a way to decrease anxiety about this uncertainty of the future. If I do it in theory just right or just enough times, then I won't have the problems. Then the things I most worry about won't happen. We also see a negative problem orientation. Those with generalized anxiety tend to have an attentional bias. They actually pay attention more to potential problems. They'll notice something and say, oh yeah, let me pay attention to that because there's more likelihood of a problem here. We talked about threat estimation in the first section of today's seminar. In any anxiety disorders, you'll see in the research just a higher proportion, a higher percentage of believing that there's more of a threat than there actually is. And along with that, there's this belief, especially profoundly with those with the OCD, that they can control their thoughts. That if they do things just right and precisely, then it will make a difference. So with obsessive compulsive disorder in particular, we see two things. We see obsessions and compulsions. And we need to make sure we know what those are to differentiate. Obsessions are the thoughts, the upsetting thoughts, images, or urges that intrude. Keep in mind what's different between someone with obsessive compulsive disorder versus someone, let's say, who has psychotic sorts of unreal thoughts is that for the person with obsessive compulsive disorder, the intrusive thoughts are disturbing. They don't want to have them. They don't want to think about that. Think of someone who has maybe like a postpartum sort of anxiety or depression. And they feel like, there's intrusive thoughts about getting rid of their child. Well, they don't want that. Or maybe there's just thoughts that they're like, ooh, this isn't me. I wouldn't do this to a person. So with obsessions, the thoughts are upsetting. With someone, on the other hand, with true delusions or psychosis, the thoughts aren't upsetting. They're congruent. So with obsessions, we're talking about upsetting thoughts, images, or urges that intrude. They're unbidden into the person's stream of consciousness. They don't want them there. Then in reaction to this, they do behaviors. So the obsessions are the thoughts, the compulsions are the behaviors. They're trying to undo something, the anxiety. Sometimes compulsions can also include mental acts. If I think enough times, if I say things in reverse, if I pick certain letters or numbers or ways of doing things, they will help me to resist and deal with some of this anxiety. They're connected to what they're intended to prevent. So it could be checking, washing, hoarding, ordering, memory compulsions. So we're looking at neutralizing rituals or themed rituals that this person does. It could be of a religious nature, a sexual nature, or aggressive nature. We talked before, and I want to talk a little bit more on this idea of dysfunctional beliefs. Especially with obsessive compulsive disorder, there's this sense of inflated personal responsibility. The idea that if I think or behave a certain way, I actually have the power to cause and, as a result, the duty to prevent possible negative outcomes. So they overestimate the likelihood of threats, not that it's a possibility and probably a small possibility, but wow, if it entered my mind, I really have to consider that it is possibly likely and maybe even more likely than I would have thought. So there's an overimportance of thoughts. There's this belief that control is actually possible. One of the things I frequently tell my clients is that control is an illusion. We never really can control things. I talk about kind of making a shift away from the idea or concept of control to more one of influence. I might be able to make a difference in situations. I might be able to increase the likelihood to a degree that this is more likely to happen than that. But to say I can actually predict control and that it's that linear is very limiting. Along with this comes this idea of perfectionism. And imagine how much shame occurs when someone has these perfectionistic beliefs. There's this belief that mistakes and imperfection are unacceptable. On the other hand, a lot of the successful treatment for OCD has to do with shame-based schema because there's this sense of something's wrong with me, I'm unclean, I'm not right, I'm not perfect, I haven't measured up, I haven't done things enough or done it the right way enough. And again, that intolerance of ambiguity or uncertainty. Now, there's different types of perfectionism. The literature actually specifies that there's a few different categories. We have adaptive perfectionists, maladaptive perfectionists, and then non-perfectionist. So adaptive perfectionists would be those people who basically feel a sense of satisfaction based on efforts, but not to the extreme or the harshness, neuroticism, or self-criticism level that a person with OCD has. So maybe I shouldn't wait until last minute to study for the test, because if I study a little bit each night, it will help me to get the concept down a little better. That's adaptive perfectionism. That makes sense. If I do certain things, it can make a positive impact on things. On the other hand, maladaptive perfectionism would be extreme judgments of oneself to where nothing's ever good enough. There's so many shoulds. There's so many of those cognitive behavioral toxic beliefs, those red flags that we talk about. There's this comparison between high performance standards and beliefs about self and what someone sees in terms of shame of, I've not measured up. Then we have non-perfectionists. It's hard to find a client that I'd say has true OCD that doesn't have quite a bit of perfectionism. So the distinctions between the adaptive and the maladaptive nature of OCD has to do with the degree of rumination. How much are there frequent, ongoing cognitions between perceived self versus actual self? Let me give you an interesting example about this one. Years ago, I remember I had a young girl. She was maybe around 8 years old, who was a client of mine. And she had a lot of body image distortions. So we actually, during one of the sessions, we had her draw out the person she wanted to be versus the person she thinks she is at this time. Just because I wanted to see her line of reasoning, she seemed convinced that she was so off from where she wanted to be. What was odd to me and pretty shocking initially was she drew the exact same picture. Same look, same ponytails in her hair, same outfit. But when she described it to me, on the one side, the person she wanted to be, the hair was even. The clothes were perfect. She felt calm. Everything from a sensory level was balanced on her body. Her stomach was more thin. She felt clean and didn't need to do as much hand washing as she was doing. This young girl would wash her hands so much that she would talk about how many, quote, squirts of the liquid soap did it take to be enough for her. And poor girl would spend a half hour, an hour, if left to her own, you know, regard, just continuing to wash and wash and wash her hands to where it was really ruining her skin. So part of the behavior program we worked on with her, instead of saying, oh, you can't have whatever squirts, was trying to get down to eventually where she had squirts, but it was two or three squirts as opposed to a whole bottle of hand washing. And actually what's interesting is we used what was rewarding to her in terms of, you know, the hand washing, the other stuff, we used that as part of the behavioral program. So she could actually choose from the Bath and Body Store more of the scents, the fragrances, try out different things, expand her horizons about the types of textures and stuff, as a reward for when she did a limited number of squirts on her hands. So for her, like I said, when she drew out those pictures, they looked exactly the same to me. That just was surprising. But the perceived self now versus the actual self, and her words were very different. So you'll see a lot of rumination about that, a lot of thoughts being consumed. You'll also see, as I hinted at a little bit ago, the sense of shame. Mistakes aren't just mistakes. They're moral failures. There's a personal self-criticism and judgment. So it is personal, according to the client. One of the cognitive behavioral messages or alternative healthier messages we eventually want to get to with that client is the idea of this is not a personal thing. That's really important that they eventually get to that because it does feel quite personal for them. So in terms of obsessive compulsive disorder, what they do is they attempt to suppress thoughts. So they might have intrusive thoughts. Remember, for someone with OCD, they don't want these thoughts. So then they fear that, oh my, if I don't do something, this absolute catastrophe is going to happen. Oh my, I must be a moral failure that I even thought of that, that I even considered that thing, that I ruminated about that. I'm not perfect. I'm, in my own judgment, more immoral, off, not measuring up. So there's a sense of extreme emotional distress that builds up. And ironically, that emotional distress increases the frequency of the thought rather than decreasing it. We have found in people with OCD patterns of maladaptive schemas, often beginning in early childhood. Let's look at what some of them are. They're centering around different themes like disconnection and rejection, impaired autonomy and performance, impaired limits, other directed thoughts about what I think other people might think of me, and finally, the area of overvigilance and inhibition. So let's look at what these are. Keep in mind, any of the erroneous beliefs our clients come to us with oftentimes have some grain of truth. And that's where that worry and that anxiety plays in, because they'll pick up on what's that grain of truth and just run with it. So let's take, for example, this first one, disconnection and rejection. There are several ways this can play out. There could be fear of abandonment. This other person might leave me. Maybe this person did actually go through a parent, a significant other, a best friend, where there was a loss. It's quite possible there's unresolved grief issues. There may be layers of not just one, but multiple perceived losses. And fear of, if I don't do the good, right, strong, perfect things, they're going to leave again. Again, it's that personal idea. If I don't do it, not that there could possibly be something wrong with the other person that they leave, or that I happen to maybe choose some of the not healthiest people who aren't very committed in relationships. So disconnection and rejection can take the form of fear of abandonment. It could be mistrust and abuse. It could be this fear that other people are just going to lie and take advantage of me. And again, in life, there's a possibility of that. But the idea that I'm living as if I have to put up my guard to such a level, I have to be ready for that, that even when someone's potentially nice and not doing that, I'm going to push them away. That's where the problem comes in. There's also this possible part of emotional deprivation, this sense of thinking about how people aren't there for me the way I want. No one ever does what I need. And again, not to say there haven't been real losses in this person's life, but it comes to a point where they almost come to expect that and really aren't open to healthy relationships at times. There could be also this sense of defectiveness and shame, that as a person, I make a personal judgment against myself that I am flawed or worthless. Not that my behavior needs to change or I could learn new skills in counseling, but I'm just off. I'm flawed. Then finally, another way disconnection and rejection can play out is in social isolation or alienation. They might feel separated from others. So we talked about one of the areas of schemas is disconnection and rejection. Another is impaired autonomy and performance. The sense of, I can't take care of myself. I need other people. And not just, I want some help or could use some help, but I desperately need other people. If I don't have them around, I'm not so sure myself. There can be schemas surrounding vulnerability to harm or illness, that I'm more vulnerable to something bad happening. I know, for example, if COVID's out there, I know I'm going to be the one that's going to get it 15 times compared to the other person next to me. Not just that I could have it at some time and I'll get past it, but no, I'm going to get it and I'm going to get it real good. I remember I had a teenager one time who had some obsessive compulsive sort of thoughts and behaviors, and she was heavily involved in sports. She had obsessions surrounding, what if I get a concussion? What if I have a brain tumor? What if I end up dying? So here she is thinking, well, my life is guaranteed to end at a young age. It's going to stop. Something's going to end my life. I just know it. So even though there is a possibility, especially in the sport she's in, of a concussion, the fact is that if she got a concussion, it would be the worst one. It would be so disabling that she couldn't possibly go on. It would impair her for the rest of her life and probably cut her life short. So vulnerability to harm and illness is one of the areas of schemas. Another one is enmeshment or underdeveloped self. Basically, I can't separate myself from other people. There's not a healthy sense of interdependence. It's like it's hard to know where someone starts and stops. Almost like the way we describe a codependent relationship. And a sense of failure. That level of comparison with others. Schemas also may surround impaired limits. Now this could take the form of entitlement and grandiosity. I'm better, I'm superior. I haven't seen a ton of this with my OCD clients, but it is one that the literature talks about. Sometimes there's almost this narcissistic sense of, I'm special, I deserve this extra special treatment. If people don't give it to me, then they're not measuring up. So kind of looking at how others treat me. Generally, though, I see more of the self-criticism type of pattern. Another way impaired limits seem to play out is through insufficient self-control or self-discipline. There's this fear of lack of restraint. People with OCD may have a tendency to worry about what others think of them to such an extreme. They're so focused on what their needs are, about making sure that other people's needs are met first, that they do whatever it takes to be approved of, to be recognized, to get what they're wanting in the long run. Schemas may also focus on the area of what we call over-vigilance and inhibition. So just this hyper-awareness of any possibility. Things like negativity and pessimism, jumping to the worst conclusions, emotional inhibition, not allowing themselves to even feel things. There's a real fear. When you think of shame, when you think of jumping through these hoops and all these comparisons, there's a fear of anything that's unpleasant. That's why we really need to clarify with our clients, emotions might be pleasant or unpleasant. They're not right or wrong. So sometimes I hear our clients come in, and when this, particularly when they have OCD, they tend to think of their emotions as wrong because they feel so uncomfortable or dirty or off or shameful. But we need to, at every chance, remind them that it's not that they're wrong. They're just really unpleasant and uncomfortable. And we can acknowledge that. We can validate that with the client. Another way we can see this overvigilance or inhibition is this unrelenting sense of standards. Just a high level of performance and sense of punitiveness, that there need to be consequences for behaviors that are off. Let's look now and make a little shift here to some things about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm just wanting to make sure we have a good overview about these. So we're talking about someone who has witnessed, whether to themselves or to someone else, an event that they perceive as traumatic to them or someone else. The key here that I can't highlight enough is the idea of perception. Something, let's say, my dad going on a business trip as a kid, I might perceive that as traumatic. My dad's leaving me. He's going again, even if it's a trip that's required for his job. Someone else might be like, oh, well, okay, he's going on a trip. He'll be back. I'll see him again. So the event causes distress. It could be restrictions in terms of emotional responsivity, emotional numbing, or it could be hypersensitivity emotionally. So both extremes we tend to see with people with PTSD. There's a belief that there might be a risk to my body, to bodily injury, to death. There's a sense of horror. There's a sense of, I can't face this. There might be nightmares. There might be intrusive memories or flashbacks. Basically, with PTSD, this kind of came out of a lot of the military kinds of stuff of the active combat duty. But keep in mind, anything can be perceived as traumatic depending on the person or situation. If you want to learn more about this topic, I encourage you to listen to or do the training on turning around trauma that I have for this cycle of the CEU courses. I talk again about whether it's a natural disaster or some kind of unforeseen weather issue, whether it's something in society. It could be a prejudice. It could be an issue about something on the job and feeling like you're not heard or favored. Or whether it's an actual abusive thing like sexual or physical abuse, domestic violence towards yourself or witnessing something like that. Any of those can be traumatic. It's not for me as a therapist to say, oh, that's only whatever. For example, I have some kids who come to me because maybe in middle school, there's some dynamics about he said, she said, who likes who doesn't like who, and who's going to be the other one's friend or who's going to ignore them at this time. And I have some clients who realize that's part of that age and stage of life, and they're going to get beyond it. The other person's just being foolish. They're jumping from friend group to friend group. But then I have some clients that, wow, that just really gets to them. So we can find either hyperarousal, disturbed sleep, irritability, being overly startled, or hypoarousal, just a sense of avoiding. Or some of both, where it goes from one extreme to the other. There's a phrase that I thought was interesting in the literature that really helped us in terms of perceiving PTSD. They call it a disorder of the past invading the present. It's basically the short-term memory being stuck in the long-term memory. Emotions tend to be stored in the limbic system of the brain. And those seem to get replayed over and over. So there's several areas we can address if we're doing therapy with someone with PTSD. We can't ignore the biology part of it, especially if things that are perceived as traumatic happen at earlier stages of development. It may result in developmental problems, medical or health issues. There may be cognitive issues like difficulties in attention, information processing or learning. Some people go through dissociation, this sense of, am I real? Did this really happen to me? Am I kind of like watching a movie outside myself? Memories may even appear distorted. We may also see difficulties in affect regulation. Just the emotional intensity alone makes it difficulty sometimes labeling or naming emotions or knowing how to process that. Some people can benefit from things like DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, which teaches the naming and processing of emotions. Attachment issues can result. Some people may vacillate even between, do I attach or cling to someone? Do I push them away? They might also have difficulty with perspective taking, with different ways of looking at things. Behavioral control might be an issue. There may be poor impulse control, aggression, or oppositional behavior. Keep in mind, if someone's hypervigilant, they may tend to not pause and do what I call the thought stopping that we might be more likely to do in a less traumatic situation. And shame, again, can be an area that needs to be looked at. A low self-esteem, a low sense of self.